This is Bob Bosselman, recorded at his home at Offley Hay, near Eccleshall in Staffordshire, by Chris Alden Lee on the 9th of September 2010. Bob Bosselman, Part 2.
Let's talk a little bit about your time at Halley, Bob. You weren't there very long, were you?
No, we were there for a month, which was a lot longer than normal, because we were putting in Halley Bay 3, I think, which was in... The whole idea was to put in a tunnel of Armco so that all the Marines came out of Stanley to help us build it.
Under the control of Big Al Smith?
Correct, yep.
What do you make of him?
Oh, a character.
When the Bransfield arrived, there was a lot of unloading to do, as there always is, and the geography of the unloading conditions wasn't very conducive, was it? There was
no
problems. What's your memories of that process?
Because I didn't know the area at all, I didn't quite understand what was going on, but basically there are a number of well-organised bays, what they call chips, which are natural bays in the ice, and there was a problem getting into the normal chip. So we were in, I think, chip 3, and therefore it was much further to take the cargo up to the new base than they were hoping.
And then it all went wrong.
It went desperately wrong on a number of occasions. We were unloading, and I can remember it absolutely clear as a bell, because I tell people this story every single day.
Give me a really good pen portrait of this.
Dave Fletcher was unloading with me, and there were about six of us. Dave Fletcher, big lad, and he was going on about, could I tie a bowline? And I'm not a climber. It's everyone will know it's the normal climbing knot. So he taught me how to, while we were waiting for the next load of cargo to come. And he was saying, you would be able to tie it with one hand. I said, what do I need to tie it with one hand for? And so anyway, he taught me, and about half an hour later, I was on the edge of the cliff, and the cliff just gave way. And we were dropped probably about 30, 35 feet. Adrian, what was his other name? Adrian and myself, anyway, both went down the cliff, and as sod's law would have it, we both landed on small icebergs, bergy bits, and therefore didn't get our feet wet. All the hawsers that holding the ship in were all either broken or ripped out, and the ship just went out laterally and came back, put the anchor, crane over, and we were told, jump, you've got one chance. That's how we got back on base.
So you fell into the space that the ship had previously occupied?
Yes.
But you didn't fall in the water?
Nope.
Because of the fortuitous positioning of...
Absolutely landed on this little ice floe.
Did you both fall on the same one?
No, we both on different ones. Adrian was on a much bigger one than me. Having got down there, Dave, bless his little cotton socks, says, I'll throw you a rope! Dave Fletcher, who had been teaching this method of doing this bowling. I'll throw you a rope! Can you tie with it? So I was then hauled up, but unfortunately my glasses were left in the water on this bergy bit, but underwater. And then Dave Fletcher again very kindly went down on the crane and with a bit of bent wire managed to get my glasses back again.
Really?
Yep.
Was that your only pair?
No, I had a dark pair as well. Yeah.
Okay. Later that night, how did you feel about that?
At the time, not a problem. And then later on, like all these accidents, which are a close-run thing, you just think, thank the Lord, it went, you know, and suddenly get a horrible feeling about it.
There was no warning, there were no cracks.
Oh, no, no, absolutely not. No, no, no. It was much, much more serious the next day, or 2 days later, because, I mean, our ice cliff only went back 20 yards, and as a result of that, only two of us went in. But the next night, when we were having smoko, it went back a heck of a lot further, probably 100 metres or something. They lost, I think, three or four sledges, and I've got a feeling one muskeg. But again, whether you're Christian or not, we all believed in some being up there who was looking after us, and it was complete fluke, it was smoko. And so we'd all come off onto the ship for smoking.
So the ship got pushed out?
Again, yeah.
And you with it?
Yes.
What would have happened if it hadn't been Smoko?
Without any shadow of doubt, 6 or 8 of us would have been killed. No question about it.
And there was, at one point there was a search for a man who was thought to be missing. Was that on that one?
Yes, because he was meant to be unloading ship. He was actually having a kip on the base, up on the base. So yes, there was an absolute panic. We were all having Smoko, bar him, and he'd gone on the last load. He'd gone up to the base.
And then there was the big ice cliff fall at night.
That was at night when we were then actually unloading off a cliff which was higher than the ship, the Bransfield, believe it or not. So the only way we could get in and off was on the crane to lift us way above the ship. And we were then on 12-hour shifts, building for 12 hours, sleeping for 12 hours. I was on the base building, and we suddenly heard that the cliff had fallen onto the ship.
But there's nobody working?
No. We'd fully unloaded there. We were just literally parked up at that time.
And again, if it had been the alternative shift?
No, the alternative, they were sleeping. So there was no unloading at that stage. We were literally just parked there to, as I said, it had all been unloaded. We were all building.
But it was, well, my understanding is that was the first night where there hadn't been any night unloading.
Correct, absolutely.
So if it had happened 24 hours earlier?
It would have been a different situation again. Yeah.
There was three fairly hefty warnings, aren't there? Was there any change of policy at the base about the unloading process?
Well, he wasn't on the base. I mean, Sir Vivian Fuchs was with us at the time. He was on the ship when it happened the last time. No, I don't think there was. I think they weren't happy at being on, not knowing the geography of Halle Bay. I was fairly sure they were not happy at unloading on the third ship anyway. They wanted to be on first ship or somewhere. But because of the ice conditions, they had no choice in that matter.
Did the men get a bit spooky about it?
No, I don't think so. I think it was just, you know, that's life.
Okay.
We were all young and, you know, beyond redemption.
You were immortal, were you?
Yeah, immortal, that's the word. Absolutely. Absolutely.
There's an incident, apparently, where you ended up with 2 black eyes. I can't quite work out what happened.
Oh, that was a complete disaster. This is moving on completely. We're at Stonington. The dogs are on the North East Glacier above a very, very steep ramp. Ramps 1 in 4 or something, which is the ramp that connects Stonington, the North East Glacier to the island itself. And my dogs were meant to be going uphill. We were right on the edge anyway, and they spun round and came downhill, capsized the sledge with me underneath it, smashed my glasses, land up with 2 black eyes. That was not an issue, really. This was just before the planes were coming back down. So a quick telex to London in those days, to Eleanor Hunlewell, can you get my mother, get some more glasses to try and catch up with it? The pilots to take to Canada to bring the plane. Eleanor Halliwell phones my mother in London and says, Mrs. Bustleman, I'm sorry, but your son's had an accident and he's broken. And the line went dead. Bearing in mind what the phones were like in 1973, you know, they were not like they are now. And mother was in absolute state, and it was 1/4 hour before Ellen came back on the phone to say, broken the glasses, can you get another pair?
Okay. And there was, when you were sledging, you got stuck in a rather large blow at one point, I believe.
In a rather?
Large blow, the big blow, you lost your tents.
Well, no, that was in the winter, yes, that was in the winter. It was... And again, we all believe in this other being. It was extraordinary. I can't remember the glacier in. We weren't that far. We were about 25 miles from base. Had some evil, evil, evil weather, so we hadn't actually been outside. We tried to feed the dogs, but believe it or not, although we were on a relatively level area, we were wearing crampons to move around on the flat and were still being blown away. So we gave up feeding the dogs. Hadn't fed them for 2 days. And on the second night, we assume a lump of ice, something came, hit the tent, ripped it completely. Peter and I were both fully clothed inside our sleeping bags. We just literally pulled it down on top of us. And about, that was, I don't know, middle of night time, 2-3 o'clock or something in the morning. And about 7-8 o'clock, the wind went down to about 40 knots. And we said, look, the only thing we can do is abandon as much equipment as we can. Keep the pup tent. The tent, the pyramid tent, was a complete waste of time. We always had a pup tent, so we'll just take that and try and get back to base. And it's one of these extraordinary things. So we did, we loaded up and just fled back to base, as I say, about 24, 25 miles, which is a good day sledging with the dogs, especially in the winter. And when we got back, Peter said, what was your reaction? I said, I don't know, but somehow those dogs knew we were in trouble. They did everything miraculously. Every command was instant response. And I don't know. I believe my dogs understand my feeling here. And there was, to me, absolutely no shadow of doubt that Peter and I felt those dogs knew exactly that we were in trouble and, you know, that we weren't stopping the night and mate. You were going to go straight through.
Did it change your views on creation or creativity or the great white God in the sky? Were your beliefs affected by these experiences?
No, I mean, I've been brought up as a Christian. I'm not an active church member, but I have always believed in something, and I don't know what it is.
Was that belief reinforced then by these incidents in the Antarctic?
Probably, yes. And most grateful for whoever or whatever it is somehow. But you know, it goes back to Shackleton's days, doesn't it, when you know, it was the fourth person walking across South Georgia with them. And you know, there is, I don't know, we just believed in something used to look after us. We were either that or we were damn lucky the whole time we were there.
Tell me about this, the scallop bed in Back Bay.
That was known to be there, and it was one of those things that every so often someone would be stupid enough to go in there and bring the scallops up and we'd have them for supper. They gave you the most almighty diarrhoea, and I don't know why the hell we had them, but it was just a different diet for a day. So, yeah, it was there, and we used to go and feed them every so often, or feed off them, rather.
Okay. Let's go back, let's talk again. Obviously, the strong point of interviewing you is to talk about the dogs and the dog work you did. And I can just turn to my other notes. I'll take a slurp of tea whilst you're at it. There were two or three things that you wrote. Famously, there was an Antarctic publication called Cura Fid.
Yep.
And you wrote Cura Hound.
Yep.
Tell me about that. I've not seen it.
You've not seen it?
No.
Only because, I mean, Cura Fid is a very simplistic first aid kit for FIDs, and he gives dose rates of anything that's aware that is there in the medical emergency kit. And the idea was to cure a hound was the same sort of idea. Because I'm the first guy to actually sledge with huskies, it was just a very, very simple first aid kit or first aid manual for what to do with dogs and dose rates of drugs that were down there.
Right, and are you aware of it being used in after you'd come back?
Sadly, 2 years after it came, the dogs came out too. Mm. So, yes, it was used, but for a very limited time.
And grow a pup.
Well, that was also the same sort of idea, was to try and... I'd forgotten that one. These dogs, we reared our own, and they were virtually fed on evaporated milk and seal meat from day one. If I actually suggested that to any of my clients now, they'd go absolutely mad. So it was trying to give an idea of how much and at what stage, when you go from minced seal to chopped up seal to whole seal meat, and give an idea of how we ought to feed these poor little hounds.
And again, it was used for a couple of years and then became a collector's item, I suppose.
Probably, yep.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. The one I have got in front of me, which I've thoroughly enjoyed reading, is The Management of Sledge Dogs in the Antarctic by R.W. Bosselman, and it's in Polar Record, volume 18, number 112, published in 1975. And it's a very comprehensive study, really, of the history of dogs in the Antarctic and how dog management's changed in those years. So let me pick you on some of the points you make, and perhaps you can elaborate on them for me if you wouldn't mind. What is the most effective Antarctic husky? Describe the perfect beast for the Antarctic jobs.
Sadly male, only because it doesn't come into season, and he's heavier. Fairly heavy. 55 kilos, that sort of weight. Longish legs and very, very good thick coat. It was very noticeable that because of the... When we started the interview, we were talking about the hereditary diseases that Andrew Bellars found down there. And as a result of that, six Greenland dogs came down, one of which sadly died in the tropics on the way down. And I had three on my team, believe it or not. And those dogs were, although they were wonderful dogs, were very, very different to the British Antarctic dog, which is almost a subspecies because he'd been bred for so long. So the British Antarctic dogs, for instance, if they get a real ball of ice on their feet, didn't seem to bother about it. So they were walking almost on stilts, these great big balls. The Greenland dogs absolutely hated it. Unlike most dogs, they were very, very hairy around the pads, so you accumulated ice very, very quickly. Our dogs, the Bass dogs, hated having a lot of snow and ice on their heads. The Greenland dogs didn't care about that at all. They had a great, almost a helmet on their head. So it was very strange to see the difference between these two types.
Do the two types of dog get on socially?
Yes. Yes, that's not an issue.
Yeah. Obviously, we touched on briefly earlier in the first part of the interview about the problems with interbreeding, but you are essentially close breeding, aren't you?
Yes.
So are you looking for a uniform dog? Are you aiming for uniformity, or were you in the 70s?
No, not really. We had that gene. I mean, they were fairly uniform anyway. There were one or two. There was a dog called Baloo, which had an unbelievably long coat. And although we kept her, I'm really not quite sure why. It was a throwback, and we wouldn't want such a long coat because it got iced up very, very quickly. So that was the sort of thing that we wouldn't breed from her at all. But we were looking for uniformity. One of the sad things about it, the way it worked, these dogs lost a heck of a lot of weight at the beginning of the summer trip. So while you wanted heavy dogs, you didn't want fat dogs. You didn't want little fat dogs. Dogs that made them heavy. You wanted a big structure, a big frame, so that they would still pull. But some of these dogs would lose 25-30% of their weight in the first month of sledging.
And that was because you couldn't give them the same...
Couldn't feed them enough.
Simply by volume?
Yes. Oh, you could have fed them enough, but you couldn't carry the weight in order to feed them enough. The whole of sledging was spent trying to cut your weight down.
When they were at base, they would get seal.
Yes.
But they couldn't have seal when they were in the field.
No, you couldn't carry the weight. One of the programmes I did was down there. We were feeding this stuff called Nutty or Nutricon, and the British Nutricon was based on whale meat. The importation of whale meat was banned in, I think, 1968, and therefore we had to find another source. So I took down a Nutty based on soya. It's the first time soya had been used to feed dogs. And I also took the New Zealand stuff, which was based on wild deer meat. And we were comparing one of the things we were doing is comparing the three diets.
This is when you got the nickname the turd burglar.
Absolutely.
Because you presumably were doing literally what it says, were you?
Absolutely, because what you do in any nutritional diet program is measure what goes in, measure what comes out. And measure the dog in between, whether it's losing weight, gain weight. So, yes, I was collecting a huge number of samples of faeces to analyse and see how much protein was actually being captured by the dog or being passed out.
Can you remember your findings?
Yeah, it was published in the... Well, it wasn't published. It was all extremely annoying. I submitted it to the Journal of Nutrition because that's where the previous work had been done. And it took so long to come back. By that time, I was in Australia, and I hadn't got my notes with me, and there was various things that wanted editing. and it never happened, which was very, very sad. But at the end of the day, the the new one, which is based on soybean, was the more efficient of the diet, and the New Zealand diet was way, way, way worse than anything we'd had.
And the dogs didn't seem to mind not having meat.
Didn't have a choice.
How do you commission somebody to make dog food out of soya?
It was made by... wasn't a problem. I can't remember who made the stuff. I want to say it's Kellogg's, but it's next door to the Kellogg's factory in Liverpool, people who made it. And it didn't have whale meat, so you know, I had to find something else. And it was as simple as that. There is a side to this, actually.
Sorry?
There is an aside to this.
Please, yes.
Because it was worse than being turd burglars, because the dogs will eat each other's feces. They're so hungry. They will eat each other's feces as quickly as you can. So you've got to get it. That's hence the turd burglar, because you had to get in there before the dogs would eat it, their own feces. So I then landed up with, I can't remember, 600 samples of dog feces. It's a big volume, which then wanted drying. We're living in a very small base. So I then actually had a tent I pitched downwind from the base where I used to boil the ruddy stuff up. This went into two man food boxes, which is now semi-dried, to come back to this country. And when it came back, it was stopped in Southampton because they thought it was some sort of drugs. And it was quite difficult, apparently, to get through customs, I'm told.
Was there a problem with the dogs eating each other's feces? Was that not... It doesn't sound terribly healthy.
It's not healthy. There's a disease around, but these dogs had absolutely no disease at all. So it's... No, it's the ultimate recycling, probably.
Okay. Right. Let's talk a bit more about breeding them. And we talked about the contraceptives in the first part of the interview, and that it wasn't possible in the field. But when you were actually wanting to breed, bringing two dogs together, how did you actually physically do that?
You had these. If you're in the field, it could be quite difficult, and sometimes you relied on the planes literally to fly the bitch or the dog backwards or forward, but generally speaking, you didn't. You tried to mate them when they're... They come on twice a year, so you try and mate them in the winter when they're on base. But bitches that are in season were hopefully brought into pens away from the male dogs. And if you wanted a mating, you brought the dog down.
And these are very much arranged marriages.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yes, yeah. Yes.
And then so would you leave them together for a while? Or?
Yes. Couple of days,
and you then assume the deed had been done.
Yes. Okay. Oh, but it's the sort of thing that hang on, we've got no sex, we've got no women, we've got no television. Sort of thing that men would stand there and watch until it happened.
Okay. And the pups would arrive, and yep. Then what's the next step?
No, step before that, about a week, 10 days before the bitch was due, she'd be taken off her chain, off her span, and brought into. Another pen, which would have some sort of packing case as a kennel, in inverted commas. She had whelped. Very often she had actually not used the packing case cover, but she'd whelp outside. You would then look at the pups, and sadly, if you didn't want the bitches, they were put down there and then, and if you did, fine. But they were, either keep the whole litter or not keep the whole litter.
So you were handling them whilst they were still blind? And...
Yes. Oh, yes, 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 yes.
Well, that was a positive thing, was it?
How do you mean?
Them, to handle the dogs
yes,
early?
Yes, yes, yes. Yep.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I mean, one of the major concerns were they were concerned about this lurkiness, this nervousness that was happening. I was instrumental, probably, in trying to get people to handle them as much as possible. So you handle them as much as possible. The bitches, although... Huskies got a terrible reputation of being nasty, horrible dogs. 99% of ours were incredibly friendly and let you handle them straight away, straight after birth. And then you'd examine them, bitches. I'd say if you needed bitches put down, they would be put down there and then on day one or before day one. And they were, handled straight away.
Did the mother respond to the loss of any of these?
No. They don't in this country. As long as they're left with some, they can't count. So they're not aware, seriously, they've got a litter of six, they're not aware if suddenly two have gone or anything like that.
Okay.
Well, they're not showing any response to that.
There was an actual infant mortality rate anyway, wasn't there?
Yes, Yes.
Again, can you elaborate on that a little?
Well, there's no heating. I mean, and if the bitch is a whelps outside, even though we're providing her with a pen, it's literally a packing case with a sack over the front, try and keep the wind out. But very often they would whelp outside, or the puppies would go outside after a very few days or hours and die from heat or from cold. Very, very quickly.
Were they good mothers?
Exactly like dogs in this country. Some were extremely good and some were pretty useless, frankly.
And then the weaning process?
Was pretty abrupt. Again, if we wanted them in the field, 5 weeks, and they would be back in the field. And the puppies would be on evaporated milk and seal meat. Minced.
This could lead to some problems, I believe.
Well, not really. The early reports were suggesting they would get terrible worms with this. Now, we know seals have got worms, but the worm wasn't spread to dogs, so I'm never quite sure where this came from. So, except the fact they caused terrible diarrhea, no, I don't think there were major problems with it. It's not a diet I would recommend now.
There was something called intussusception?
Intussusception is a very common problem in dogs anywhere, and it occurs in this country, where the intestines basically works like a worm. You've got a continuous gut movement. And if one end stops and the other goes, the intestine just goes on top of itself. And as a result of that, causes complete blockage. So, yes, that's a consequence of... It can be a consequence of worms, but it's normally a consequence of diarrhoea.
Right, because of the seal meat and the...
Possibly, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, in a way, that was a natural selective process that the stronger dog survived.
No, I wouldn't have thought so. I think it's bad luck.
Okay.
I mean, where you see interception in this country is nearly always in dogs under 6 weeks of age.
So the pups then, once they'd been separated from their mother, the pups had a bit of free time, didn't they, really?
Yes, and we tried to actually, although it was pretty revolting because they're on mostly seal meat, so disgustingly black, tarry feces, and we tried to bring them into the hut most nights just to associate with humans. Well, you can imagine having 10, 15 non-house-trained puppies with black scour going through the hut. Although everybody loved it, the bloke who was on gash, on cleaning, did not love it, went round with spent his time with a bucket and mop following behind these things. But no, everybody loved it, and it was very, very good form of relaxation for everybody on base, frankly, playing with the puppies.
At what point would you start thinking about teaching the pups what their job was going to be?
Generally speaking, a year. So they were weaned at about 5 or 6 weeks. They would stay in a cage on minced seal meat, graduating to chopped seal meat, graduating to lumps of seal meat. They would go on to a span at about 6 months and then normally go out to start doing work at about a year.
And the six-month span was because that would be when they start fighting?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also the management of them. I mean, if they're in a cage, someone's got to clean them out. If they're on a span, then I'm afraid they don't get cleaned out. They've got a fairly big area to work over and we rely on the snow to cover it up.
So that's 6 months of inactivity, but on a span?
Yes.
Did that lead to psychological problems, these poor things?
No. And one of the other reasons, important reason, because thinking about it, the earlier days, these dogs were actually released and vast numbers died, lost. They went out to sea, basically, chasing penguins or something like that, fell down crevasses and were lost, went onto sea ice, which was blown out, and there were very, very heavy losses. So bearing in mind, in the summer, we've only got two people on base, mechanic and the radio operator. They needed kind of control of the dogs.
So preservation, then?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
You say after a year, some of the other countries seem to work their dogs much younger than that, don't they? Or didn't they at that time?
The South Africans did, yes. And we would too if there was a need. If there wasn't a need, we wouldn't. So, I mean, some of the dogs were, working 8 months, but not, that's pretty unusual.
I remember reading something about the fact that if they were working too young in their lives, then osteoporosis would...
Well, that was our major concern.
Would come earlier in their lives.
The work that Andrew Bellars had done, which was suggesting it wasn't hip dysplasia but osteoarthritis. Then if the dog... The dogs were sexually mature at about 6 or 8 months, but they weren't mature from the bone point of view until they're about 15 months. So if you do work them too hard too early, you can cause chaos to the joints.
And the working life of a dog would be how long?
About 8 years.
So take me through the training process then. How would you introduce the dog to the idea that life was not actually just lounging around doing nothing all day?
Yeah, no, but you're trying to make them enjoy it. Husky pulls naturally. So you start, we have a team of nine, four sets of two and then a leader in the front, generally speaking, in a kind of herringbone formation. So most of the dogs were started right at the back or behind the back pair, as close to either on the carabiner, which was the attachment of the central rope, which was fairly far back, or actually onto the what we call the cow catcher, which is part of the sledge, to teach them they've got to pull and keep pulling. Once they've learned that, then they move further up, depending on whether they're intelligent or not, or whether they're just going to pull.
And how do they learn? So they learn to follow orders by watching what the other dogs do.
Oh, totally, yes.
And associating the dog's response to your calls.
But you're really, in the ideal world, would be that the first three dogs know the command of left and right, and everyone knows the command of stop and start. Because if you actually turn, one of the biggest problems, if you're trying to turn left or right, if you start them going and the back pair have learnt, they will swing the whole sledge round very, very quickly indeed. So you're trying to, when I was doing it, I was kind of shouting to my lead dog, Beast, rah, rah, Beast, rah, and he'd start going right and immediately got on the right angle, ha, straight again, and try and pull them straight. So whereas if everybody knows that, you can imagine the whole lot just turns a right angle virtually very, very quickly indeed. And then the guys in the front, the leader, hasn't got the strength to pull the team back on course again.
There are various stories of dogs seeming to know how to get home or seeming to know where they're meant to be going towards.
Oh, but every dog in the world does that. But there, I'd agree with that.
There's a natural instinct then, to homing instinct.
Somehow, yes.
The lead dog. Let's talk about him for a little while. We talked earlier about choosing the lead dog, but the lead dog, of course, is the one that's most likely to fall into a crevasse, isn't it? So they're more accident-prone than the others. Is that fair?
Yes and no. Could fall in, but he could be the one that actually gets over, luckily, because he's probably not the heaviest dog, and he might get over before he's causing the bridge to collapse, so it's the next dog's. In my case, Beast... My lead never went down. I put Debbie down a couple of times and she was the first pair, but most of mine was the third pair that went down.
Right, because the bridge is okay for a while, but once the third pair of dogs get to it, it's been weakened by the first
one. That's right.
And the lead dog's a single dog, therefore it's not so heavy.
Yes.
Okay, I see. There are stories also of dogs going down crevasses and then falling out of their harnesses. Mm. This is before your time. And I gather you were able to do something about that.
No, and this happens the whole time, unfortunately. And to me, I'll probably get rullocked by my colleagues, but it's bad management because we should spend most of the time adjusting the harnesses. As I said earlier, dogs lose a huge amount of weight at the beginning of the trip, so the harness has got to be continually made smaller and smaller. And then if they get put on weight, made bigger again. It's purely because they're slipping out of the harness.
Right. So when dogs have fallen out of the harness, it's actually because the harnesses weren't tight enough.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. That clarifies that. Did you ever have to go down and get one out?
I didn't. We were very fortunate our year. We didn't lose a dog. That was extremely rare. And I think it was just good fortune rather than good driving, I have to say that. And to be fair, that's why we use dogs. I'm sorry, it's a horrible thing to say, but That's why we use dogs. I mean, Beast was more of a coward than I am. And if he came across crevasses, very frequently he'd turn left or right at an angle. And before I knew the dog, I used to go forward and thumb him and say, come on, go forward. But he would turn left or right and then suddenly go back again. And he'd find a much better bridge than I'd anticipated. And he'd found a better bridge before I even knew we were in crevasse areas. And that's what we use huskies for. And it is far more important, I'm afraid, to lose a husky than to lose a human.
Mm. Okay. The leader had to be a friendly animal.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, because we got these lurky ones, what we called lurky ones, which are nervous ones, they would never respond the same way. If you went up to them, they would kind of cringe and run to the far end of the span. You've got to have someone who you relate to. It's no more different than someone here, I don't shoot, but someone having a, you know, you can't shoot with a nervous dog. You've got to have someone who, a dog that respects you, that you get on well with as a mate or whatever. Mm. And, you know, almost you'll enjoy each other's company. Whereas if you've got a nervous one, you know, if you're trying to give a command to a nervous dog, it's going to sit down and cringe rather than go forward and keep going. So lurky dogs were bad news. And, you know, they, occasionally they did. The toggle got frozen and they got loose. It could be days before you caught the damn dog again. And it was one of these extraordinary things. I met a dog called Kovic, which was a New Zealand dog. That occasionally got loose, and he was relatively nervous when I got him first. He was right towards the end, and he would get loose, but if we were running, he'd get into exactly his right position in the team, run all day in that position, wouldn't pull, obviously, because he wasn't attached. And when you told camp for the night, you'd kind of quietly go up to him, he'd disappear off. Couldn't catch him.
Chewing problems.
Well, that's where I fell out with Andrew Croft completely. We didn't get much chewing problems, I'm glad to say. But if they do chew, of course, it's a disaster because it's all rope. So, you know, they can get loose at night. We did have one dog who got loose at night. I can't remember who it was, and ate a vast amount of our food and dog food and can cause chaos. I mean, that we rely on them and they're all on ropes. So if they get loose, if they chew, they get loose and can eat anything, frankly. And they do eat anything.
How do you stop them from chewing, or what do you do to prevent them getting
We personally away? Didn't. And that's where, whereas before they were doing, one of the things, well, people did try was dragging a rope, it sounds horribly cruel now, dragging a rope through their mouth, sawing it backwards and forwards to make the mouth sore. I personally didn't think it worked.
Right. So because the mouth was sore, they wouldn't chew?
Yes, that was the theory, yes.
Okay, sounds a bit dramatic, doesn't it?
It's pretty barbaric, yeah.
Yeah, it's okay. I like this idea early in a lead dog's career, you might actually go out there in front yourself, so it'd be a man on a ski showing the dog the way.
We try to discourage that as much as possible. Now, the early reports would say that, and daft as it sounds, some of the very last reports were doing that. The guy whose name I can't remember, who went right the way across, American guy from Hope Bay, they were leading the whole way with a man. That was actively discouraged from our point of view.
Because
I mean, basically, you want the dogs to do the work. And the whole idea was the dogs would go in front rather than a human lead. We didn't have the manpower. I mean, you know, there was one dog driver and a team. So if I went in front, who's going to be at the back to manage them? And they actually decided to disappear off. I'm left there like an idiot in the front. So.
The reports in some of the in the earlier, before your time, of men on skis actually sort of trying to entertain the dogs or encourage them to follow them.
Yes, I know. Yeah. We were adamantly against that sort of thing, actually.
And there was also some management of loads. If one team was faster than the other, how would you...
But the whole idea is to try and get to the end at the same time. The lead team is much more difficult to lead, whereas the team behind have got someone to follow. So, you know, naturally they're going to try and catch them up. And, more important, the lead team is making a track. So depending on the snow conditions, if you had very deep, soft snow, the lead team might only have 200 pounds weight, whereas the one behind would have 600 or 700 pounds.
Because he's following in his footsteps.
Because he's following in his footsteps. If it was hard conditions or ice, then the differential between the two might only be 100 pounds. So it depended on the conditions, depending if it was uphill, downhill, and everything else. And if you had a good mate, and I was very fortunate with Peter, he was very good to me, if suddenly Peter was up my backside the whole time, and I didn't be able, couldn't get away. We'd chuck up a box of Nutty, which was £50, and he'd take extra weight to try and slow him down. And conversely, if I got away, I'd stop sometime and take a load off him. And you know, you're always trying to balance it out. So there's no science behind it, but you know your teams. You start the day thinking you know what the snow conditions are. They can change dramatically during the day, so the food was chucked backwards and forward.
Was this always done willingly, or was there a certain amount of... Could there sometimes be a certain amount of pride at stake?
Oh, there was probably more of a problem taking weight off than taking it back. You know, there is a certain amount of pride, yes. But at the end of the day, we're all trying to travel as much as far as we can and arrive there at the same time. So, you know, yes, that occasionally one of us would get way in front. And you'd think, well, you know, the guy behind would say, well, why the heck is he stopping and taking someone by weight and resenting it? And occasionally the guy was right at the backside the whole day and you're thinking, you know, why isn't he offering to take weight? So, but generally speaking, it's done with very good spirit.
Sometimes you have to stop, don't you? What was the most efficient way of bringing your sledge to a halt?
Depends where you are. I mean, if you're on deep snow, you just say, ah, now, and they'll stop just like that. If you're on icy conditions where the sledge is going very easily, then we would, again, depend on what you're doing. If you're ski-oaring, which is skiing on skis behind the, or alongside the ski, you just drop back and then bring your right ski, in my case, onto the brake, which is a plank of wood with two nails in it, and you press hard on that and scream very slowly, very quietly, now. Now, stop you. Now, getting more and more distressed as you go on.
Did you have any incidents?
Oh, yeah, plenty. Oh, gosh, yes.
Okay.
Usually downhill. And fast downhill is wonderful when it goes well. It is horrendous when it goes badly because if you're going down on glare ice or ice, the sledge is going faster than the dogs. And even though you've got rope brakes or chain brakes and you're hanging on to dear life, taking all your weight on the nails on the sledge, you are screaming your dogs to go faster and faster for fear of running them over.
Did that ever happen?
Oh, yes. Very good brake if you've got a dog under your sledge, but it's not recommended.
Did the dog survive?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Right. What was your feeling... You were back here by that time. What was your feeling when you heard that the dogs were being banned in the Antarctic?
Banned entirely?
Yeah.
Saddened, really. I find the whole thing is a little bit strange, but I can half understand it. The fact that everything has to come out now, and I mean everything, is understandable in a way. And round bases, I have absolutely no problem about that at all. But in the field, where it's such a huge place, and if, you know, human waste has to come back, as it does, and nothing's left behind, I can half understand it, but is it totally necessary? And I feel dogs are in the same sort of line. The whole way that bass is run now, probably dogs wouldn't work, because they are going further afield, and they're not there for the winter. And I think it was necessary for us to be present with dogs. I mean, there's no way you could have a skeleton staff at Rotherham looking after the dogs and the people fly in whenever it is, November time, and take a dog team out. It wouldn't work. You'd have far too many accidents and injuries. I mean, that was the main advantage of us being out there in the winter. Didn't get a great deal of work done, but you've got the experience of the dogs in safe times. So it's a total change in the way it's worked.
What happened to Bob Bosselman when he came out of the Antarctic?
I worked in the Falkland Islands for a spell.
In the Falkland Islands?
Yes. And then came
back. As a vet?
Yes.
How did that come about, Bob? Was that reluctance to come home, or...?
No, not at all. There hadn't been a vet. Alison McRae was the first... The vet before me was with the government. And so there hadn't been a vet there for 23 years. And I was very keen to work there. I'd done a bit of work on my way down. I'd spent a month there on the way down. Got a very good reception for the farmers. So I was very keen to work on the way back. And Ministry of Overseas Development were prepared to pay me. So I spent 7 months there, then came back to Cambridge to write up the work that I'd done. That was a condition that Bass would release me as long as I would come back. So I came back, and then I was hoping to go back to the Falklands, but to this day I haven't a clue what happened. There was some political nonsense that wouldn't allow me back.
Are you referring to the Falklands conflict or something else?
No, not at all. No, I when I left the Falklands, I had a word with the governor, whose name I can't remember, and he said, would you be prepared to come back when I finished with Bass? And I said, very definitely. There were programs that I'd started I wanted to finish. Then he said, well, write me a report and tell me what you want. And simple things, they promised me transport in the Falklands, and I never, ever got transport. I had to beg and steal. I wanted accommodation. Yes, I had a room in a house because it was vacant, because the people were actually in England at the time. So it was very, very basic what they offered me, and I felt their side of the contract, with Ministry of Overseas of the Element who were paying me, the host country should provide some basic things. So I came back here. Ministry of Overseas of the Element asked me if I would be prepared to go back again. The answer was yes, but I'm now married. My wife's a veterinary nurse, so I expect her to be able to fly. Flying was paid for by the government, because she will be helping me with my work and things like that. And I want transport. I'll take my own Land Rover. Don't have a problem if you ship it there. There are various things like that. And the next thing is the chief secretary of the Falkland Islands said he's not coming back. I've never met the man. Hadn't met him before. He was a new chief secretary, new governor. The Ship Owners Association were in conference at the time. Were saying, why isn't he allowed back? So, you know, I would have thought, you know, if having got back, they all said, thank God we got rid of him, he was a dreadful man. To my face, they were very, very pleasant. Then fine, but they all wanted me back. Mm-hmm. The governor, my old governor, who was now in the Foreign Office, sent me a very nice note saying, I'm very sorry you're not going back. And I would love to know what stopped me, but one of these days we'll find out.
Writing up your notes, I haven't really asked anybody this before because a lot of people have to do it. Is that... What is it like being back in Cambridge, having to write up your notes? Is it a wistful experience?
I'm not a researcher, and I was back in the neurological department trying to do nutritional work. First thing is boiling these ruddy faeces up again. So my colleagues suggested it should be a nighttime task, which I did. So this was all air-dried at night. And as long as I finished about 6 o'clock in the morning, opened all the windows... and then went to bed at 8 o'clock, they were happy with it. So, no, it was good, and I did enjoy it. I got quite a lot out of it. Unfortunately, I didn't get as much publications as I wanted, because straight after that, we went to Australia, and it took so long to be edited back to us that the time I actually got the papers that wanted editing, I was in Australia, and my stuff was still in Cambridge, sadly. And I regret that. I regret it a little, actually.
So the, Australia was the next step in your career as a vet?
Yeah.
Did the time out in the Antarctic help you with your future career, or did it actually hold you back because you'd missed those critical months or years?
I was concerned it was going to hold me back. In effect, it's made no difference at all. Very, very happy 18 months sojourn and thoroughly enjoyed it.
Have you ever had a treat of husky since?
No.
If a husky came into your surgery at in Staffordshire tomorrow, how would you feel?
Oh, there are a few spits and there are no huskies. I've seen a few huskies, but I actually haven't treated them. Great, and I'm like any other FID. I'm quite happy to tell some terrible tall stories. That's how it is.
You have been, you might not have been back to the Falklands, but you have been back to the Antarctic. You were on the 2005 Bay trip.
Yes, yeah.
So that's 30 years later.
Yep.
And you got into Stonington.
Yep.
Tell me about that.
That was wonderful. That was a highlight of the trip. That's what we all wanted to do, and it was just wonderful. We left Ushuaia, went straight down there, woke up one morning, and there we were. Parked outside. Magic. The sad thing is, everybody thoroughly enjoyed it. My wife included, absolutely thought it was wonderful. But the cloud base was something like 1,500 feet or something. So we really didn't get the real magic of the place. I mean, yeah, they thought it was wonderful, but I knew it could be even better. But it was, yeah, it was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful occasion.
What was it like stepping back onto onto base, inside your heart?
Like this interview, you just, lots of lovely memories come back, and it's such a long time ago, and it's such an unusual thing that you forget half of it. And I was saying to you, off tape, you know, you talk to the WI and people like that, and they ask questions, all these memories come back, and they're very, very happy memories. So, yeah, it was wonderful going back, and there were things that you suddenly remembered that you'd basically forgotten for 30 years.
Did anything take you aback?
The thing that really is staggering now, that Stonington is an island. The ramp has gone completely. The Northeast Glacier has gone completely. We couldn't see the Debenham Islands. You can now see them clearly. And if you believe or don't believe in global warming, go down there, and you can't do anything else but believe in global warming. That was the real frightening, to see the changes, the glaciers around there.
Is there anything else you'd like me to ask you? I think I've...
No, not really.
I think I wanted to cover.
Thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you very much indeed, Bob.
No problem at all.